All right. This is French Revolution Basics. This is the standard version. If you have the ER version, head back to the website and pick that one up instead. All right. This is a long one, so let's start it off. Anyway, let's go with the intro. So the French Revolution is one of the most important events in all of history. It is responsible for creating modern governments, as well as the ideas of nationality and patriotism. It also provided concrete examples of government in action. The Code Napoleon created a rational basis of law that is now used in most of the world. The levy en masse created modern draft armies and founded the idea that all people of a nation contribute to a war together, which is called total war. The metric system also revolutionized the conduct of science and of engineering. But the revolution itself is like a mess. It is one of the most complex events that you can study. Exactly who wants what or why certain things occur can be pretty difficult to track. So in general, one can divide the revolution into four phases. Phase one is the bourgeois revolution. So this is when the middle class rises up, overthrows the nobility, and attempts to create a constitutional democratic monarchy that values trade and business. It creates substantial reforms, but ultimately remains pretty moderate. Then there's the radical revolution, phase two. The former allies of the bourgeoisie rise up against the bourgeoisie, mostly urban poor, who are more radical in their ideas. They hijack the revolution, and they attempt to bring about much more extreme reforms. Then there's phase three, which is the bourgeois reaction. So now the bourgeoisie recapture power and roll back most of the extreme reforms. The government doesn't work, and it's corrupt, and it's not well-liked. And then lastly, there's phase four, which is Napoleon. France's most successful general ends the revolution and builds an autocratic empire that is based partly on the ideas of the original revolutionaries. France fights and conquers most of Europe under Napoleon before he is eventually defeated. Now, take a moment to fill out those sections. Okay, and let's talk about the Ancien Régime. So the Ancien Régime refers to about a 300-year period from 1500 to 1792. The Ancien Régime was a term used to refer to the French political system before the French Revolution. The Ancien Régime was what is sometimes called a post-feudal society, which means that it still had a lot of the traits of feudalism, with like nobles that had a fabulous amount of wealth and power, and peasants who had almost no rights. However, the actual system of like manors and landholding that was feudalism had mostly disappeared after the Black Death. Since 1600, the monarchs of France had been slowly centralizing their power, slowly breaking the power of nobles, and bringing all political control into the hands of the king. This was done partly by building fabulous royal palaces, where nobles would naturally gather and where the king could keep an eye on them. Alright, take a moment to fill that one out. And let's turn to the three estates. So since the Middle Ages, France was technically divided into three estates, which were basically social classes. At the top were priests, who were immune to all taxes and collected 10% of the income of all people in the third estate, in what was called the tithe, which is a special religious tax. Then there were nobles, who were also immune to most taxes, though not all, and who also were owed special taxes from the peasants of the third estate. Those are called seigneurial dues. The nobles and priests combined for about 3% of the French population. The other 97% belonged to the third estate. This was split between the middle-class bourgeoisie, the urban poor, and peasants. All of these people combined to own just 35% of the land of France, made 25% of the money, and yet had to pay for almost all of the taxes the government collected, as well as having to support the priests and the nobles, who both lived off the money taken from the third estate. All right, take a moment to fill out that section. Debt crisis. So the Ancien Régime was awful, outdated, and inefficient. The king could only really tax the third estate, and they didn't really have all that much money. And they were already being taxed to extraordinary levels, like 30 to 60% of their income going away as taxes. The decisive issue was actually the American Revolution. Before 1776, France had been fighting Britain and had lost five wars in the last 8 decades. This was their chance for France to strike back, and they successfully did so. The American Revolution was a huge victory for France. However, it cost so much money that France found itself struggling to pay back its loans. In 1787, half of France's government revenue, half, went to just paying back the interest on those loans. Added to this were problems with farming. France's population had been growing recently, especially in the urban population, and its inefficient farming system struggled to produce enough food. The result was starving peasants who hated the nobles, who even further taxed them, and in 1775, so many peasant riots broke out that it was called the Flour War, and in 1788, another bad harvest threatened to repeat those troubles. The Ancien Régime tried to fix these problems, but it was desperate by 1787. And that leads us to the first part of the revolution, the aristocratic revolt. So, from 1787 to 1789 is what is called the aristocratic revolt. The aristocratic revolt is not usually considered to be part of the revolution, just a prelude to it. And what it was an attempt by nobles to move in the opposite direction of the French Revolution, towards less rights for the common people and more inequality between the taxes, between the classes, sorry. In 1787, the government admitted that it could not pay back its debts without changing the government. To try to pay down the enormous debt, the king looked to the only groups in France who were not taxed, the nobles and priests. The nobles had lost most of their power since the 1500s, but they still were exempt from taxes, and they owned most of the wealth in France. However, the nobles refused to pay without regaining some of those lost privileges. They wanted a monopoly on government and military offices. They wanted more control of the peasantry and greater protection of the French agricultural economy. The king attempted a number of methods to force noble compliance, but it proved powerless. And that leads us to phase one, the bourgeois revolution. The bourgeois revolution begins with the Estates General in 1789. The king needed support to force the nobles to pay taxes and to reform the deteriorating government. In a last-ditch effort to find the support, the king and his advisors turned to an ancient institution called the Estates General. The Estates General was a meeting of all the three estates in a huge parliament, and had only been called once since the Middle Ages in 1618, which is almost 200 years before this. In it, each estate had equal representation of 300 delegates. The 300 delegates from the first estate represented 150,000 priests, the 300 delegates from the second represented 350,000 nobles, and the 300 delegates from the third estate represented 3 million bourgeoisie and 22 million peasants or working poor. The inequality of this was obvious, and it was hated by the Third Estate. The Third Estate wanted reform even more than the nobles, and this was their chance to get it. They argued it was grossly unfair that they should have no more vote than the other estates, who they vastly outnumbered. The king, needing support from the Third Estate, agreed and doubled their representation to 600 delegates. This pleased the Third Estate, and they launched into preparations with enormous enthusiasm. However, the king began to realize that he wanted the proposed reforms of the Third Estate even less than the proposed reforms the nobles wanted. So on the day the Estates General met, it was suddenly announced that the estates would vote as a whole estate, basically meaning that the first estate had one vote, the second had one, and the third had one, regardless of how many delegates were in each. Now on to the tennis court oath. The Third Estate felt cheated, like they had been tricked into supporting something that they would have resisted. They refused to follow the rules, and they stated that they would meet in one huge hall, all 1,200 delegates, to create France's new constitution. They worked for a few days in this manner, while the king watched worriedly. Finally, the king locked the door to their assembly chamber, not letting them in. The Third Estate delegates met then in an indoor tennis court, and they decided there whether to give in or to continue their work. There they decided to continue, and they made their famous tennis court oath, a promise to never break up until France had a constitution. More critically, they declared themselves to be the National Assembly of France, and invited the other two estates to join them. After a couple days, most of the First Estate joined, and so did a handful of sympathetic nobles. which leads to the storming of the Bastille. So the people of France had felt cheated by the Estates General, and riots broke out all across France, especially in Paris. However, when word came that the delegates of the Third Estate had taken power into their own hands, the people celebrated, and thousands demonstrated in Paris in favor of the National Assembly. But the king watched in growing concern. Rumors began to circulate that he planned to end the assembly by force if necessary. The people of Paris feared that war was coming, and they wanted to arm themselves and to show the king that he had no power to fight the will of the people. Their target was the Bastille, a medieval castle/prison in the heart of Paris, where the king's political prisoners were held, tortured, and sometimes killed, though not in many years. The castle was stormed, some of the king's soldiers killed, and a few people were freed. No weapons were found, but it sent a message to the king. He was no longer in control. Many date this attack as the beginning of the revolution. Now on to the Women's March in 1789. The real turning point, however, is the less noted Women's March. Hungry, and hearing that the king and queen were hoarding bread, an army of women marched on the Versailles, the palace where the king lived. They dragged cannons, and they carried the heads of murdered guards on pikes, and at the gates they demanded bread, but there was none to be found. But there was a second demand. Versailles was several miles away from Paris, and it made the people feel like the king was hiding from them. They took him from Versailles, and they brought him to Paris, to a castle in the city called the Tuileries. There he would rule France, but he could be also a hostage if he needed to be. And from here on, the king realized that he could not directly fight the revolution and would typically surrender to its demands. All right, the National Constituent Assembly, 1789 to 1791. After the Third Estate took control, they formed the National Constituent Assembly, a legislature for France. Under this name, they began to form the basis for a constitutional monarchy. The king mostly went along with the changes, wielding the power he did have to protect priests and nobles from the more vengeful ideas of the Third Estate. And the assembly was pretty moderate. Most of the delegates of the Third Estate had been bourgeoisie, who had money and mostly just wanted basic rights, fair laws, and a more modern economic system. All things that the king also wanted. This was not the peasants who wanted land distribution and wealth distribution, or the urban poor who hated priests and wanted to see France divorced from religion. This was a moderate revolution, and it was extremely successful for a while. The most memorable acts of the revolution came from this period, at least the most memorable good ones. The last remnant of feudalism was abolished in the first few months. A universal code of rights known as the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen was created, and finally the first French constitution was written, and it was finally signed in 1791, some 2 years after the beginning of the revolution. The king did not want the constitution, but he was still part of its creation, refusing certain parts of the constitution until it was at least somewhat palatable to him. He eventually signed it, and the revolutionary government became a working government, a constitutional monarchy. And it was called the Legislative Assembly, from 1791 to 1792. So, technically, the king was the head of the French government, but he honestly had very limited powers, more comparable to, like, the U.S. president than a king in the true sense. The successor to the National Assembly, the Legislative Assembly, had the actual power. This was the government of the bourgeoisie, ruled by the principles of individual and economic freedom and the sanctity of rights. It was based upon reason, but it was also moderate. Only men could vote, and only those who owned land could vote, which was only about 10% of the French population. So, how did it do? Honestly, not very well. France still struggled to pay back its debts. They started to use this paper currency called the assignat. But the currency was in free fall. By 1792, it had lost 25% of its value in just over a year. The poor were still suffering, more, in fact, even than before, because the new individualist government put no restriction on grain prices, which had now soared. The king was growing increasingly fearful of the revolution, and he fled France in 1791. But he was caught just before he could cross the border. It seemed like his plan was to seek safety with his brother-in-law, Marie Antoinette's brother, who was the Emperor of Austria. The Emperor of Austria was a vocal enemy of the revolution, and many of the more radical people in France wanted to see the king executed for treason. By 1792, France was at war with both Austria and Prussia. France's greatest general, Demurez, had betrayed France and emigrated to Prussia, where he was now fighting against France. France was not doing well in these wars either. Enemy armies operated deep inside France's borders. Many of the smaller cities in France were now under siege by these invading armies. And France had political issues, too. Many, especially among the urban poor, began to complain that this government had not really lived up to the ideas of the Enlightenment. They saw the government as too moderate, more concerned with staying wealthy than actually reforming France. These radicals increasingly identified with the term Jacobin, the political party that came to stand for extreme reforms. Meanwhile, many of the peasants felt that the government was already going too far. The government had forced all priests in France to swear allegiance to France rather than the Pope, and these peasants now turned against the Paris government, who they now saw as liberal radicals, and by 1792, most of the countryside, 75% of France's departments, had rebelled against the central government, attempting to remove the radical influence they saw there. This leads us finally to phase two, the Radical Revolution. So it starts at the National Convention. In the summer of 1792, France was in crisis. Rumors were spreading that the king and thousands of imprisoned noble supporters were planning to escape and take back control from the people. So on August 10th, radicals took over. Angry Parisians stormed the prisons. The king was taken hostage. Over 1,000 of his supporters were murdered in their cells. The radicals declared the monarchy to be at an end. Back at the National Assembly, the moderates panicked and many fled the city, fearing they too would be killed. Jacobins now controlled the government, and they created a new constitution. They allowed every man to vote, and they promised to lead France into a new age of reason and enlightenment. The Reign of Terror, 1793 to 1794. So the new revolutionary government, known as the National Convention, saw France was in crisis, and they decided that extreme actions were needed to save the country. With the revolution under threat, more and more radical people take power to defend the revolution. This culminates with the creation of the Committee of Public Safety, a small council given dictatorial powers over all of France. They make it their mission to end all disloyalty to the revolution. Maximilien Robespierre eventually rose to the lead of the Jacobins and of the committee. He was firmly idealistic and totally uncompromising. Under his leadership, France entered the Reign of Terror. The symbol of his new government would be the guillotine, a device used to behead people. The king would be one of the first to meet it. He was executed for treason in 1793, but many more would be executed. This new radical government did not suffer enemies. Those who fought against it died. Those who spoke out against it died. Those who held too closely to the old ways died. Over 13 months, 16,000 people are executed by the government, mostly on suspicion of being anti-revolutionary. All right, the radical reforms. So the National Convention had no desire to be moderate. It believed that all of France, working together under the power of the central government, could fix any problem. It believed in protecting the poor and the disenfranchised. It believed in breaking the power of religion over the people of France, and it believed in destroying all those who would stop France's progress. The economy under the bourgeoisie had been extremely free from rules, but that had hurt the poor, not helped them. This new government removed economic freedoms. The prices of all major goods sold in France were set by a new law known as the price maximum. If you were caught selling things for more money, you could be executed, and many were for that crime. For the first time in 5 years, bread prices began to fall, and many peasants laid down their arms, satisfied by this new government. The other big law was the levée en masse, which is one of the most important laws in history. It stated that all people of France are responsible to defend her in times of war. Regardless of wealth or class, all young men served in the army. Others would do their part by building weapons or rationing supplies for the soldiers. This gave France the largest army in Europe overnight, and it allowed for the creation of a wartime economy. This new army also believed in their task, that they were fighting for freedom and for liberty. And with this new army, the National Convention reversed the course of history. It crushed the German armies invading France. It butchered those peasants still in rebellion. And soon it began to invade France's neighbors to free them from their own rulers. But the convention wasn't done there. It wanted to end the influence of religion over the mind and to celebrate reason above all. France adopted a new calendar. The months, the days, and even the year were changed to remove Christian influences. 1793 was now the year 2, dated from the end of the monarchy. Conflicting non-Christian churches appeared. There was the Church of Reason, which basically just worshipped humanism and rationality. And then there was a Cult of the Supreme Being, which worshipped a god, but not a Christian god, a sort of unknowable force. And lastly, triumphs of the Jacobin Republic. For all its flaws, the convention was extremely effective. In 14 months, France went from a failing state to the greatest country on earth, all because of the National Convention. The convention also had its triumphs. It was the first to recognize all men as voters. It gave women rights, and it abolished slavery. None of these things were done by any of the other revolutionary governments. Of all France's governments, the Jacobins were the ones that most believed in the principles that had created the revolution. All right, phase 3, the bourgeois reaction. All right, starting off with the Thermidorian reaction, 1794. So on the 9th day of Thermidor, in the year 3, which we call July 27th, 1794, people had had enough. So many had gone to the guillotine, even many of the heroes of the revolution. Danton, Brissot, the Eglantine, Venard, Hebert had all been champions of the people, but they were now headless. Finally, the people rose up against the Committee of Public Safety, and now the committee itself was sent to the guillotine, starting with Robespierre himself. This mass execution was called the Thermidorian Reaction. The Jacobins were banned from government, and once again the bourgeois took over. All right. That leads us to the Directory. The Directory lasted from 1795 to 1799. So the convention was put to an end by a third French constitution. And this was a fairly conservative government that was ruled by a council of 5 men known as the Directory. It ended many of the laws the bourgeois had hated. The price maximum was ended. Slavery was reintroduced in many colonies. Women lost many of their rights. But the Directory was just not a success. France's money started again to plunge. The government was repeatedly involved in corruption, and a number of ugly scandals made it look really bad. The radical element hadn't been defeated either, and still occasionally tried to seize the government. And now many of the nobles were returning too, and they also made several attempts at the government. So the Directory's answer to both of these things was the army. Again and again and again and again and again, the army stepped in to save the government. Which leads us to phase 4, Napoleon. So Napoleon's rise from 1799 to 1804. So France's greatest soldier was named Napoleon Bonaparte. He had proved himself again and again since 1793 when he was swept into command. He had also survived the Jacobin purges in 1795, but his close ties to them brought him credibility amongst the radicals. In 1799, Napoleon and two of his allies led a coup d'etat against the government and replaced the democratic-ish Directory with a military oligarchy led by the Consulate, which was a 3-member council. Now, from the very beginning, Napoleon was the leader. And slowly he removed all remnants of democracy and just stopped pretending. So he became first consul in 1800, which put him over the other two members. And then in 1802, he became first consul for life, in which he no longer had to be even elected. And then finally, he just dissolved the consulate in 1804 and crowned himself emperor of the First French Empire. All right, Napoleon's government. So Napoleon believed in many of the ideas of the revolution, but he also believed in order. So he began to recreate France. He took many of the institutions of the government from the revolutionary period and rebuilt them from the ground up to be more efficient and more hierarchical, with people clearly in charge of other people. He did the same with the army, and he did the same with professors and colleges. But his most important work was the Code Napoleon. He didn't write it, but he did commission its creation. He put his name on it. What it was a complete rewriting of the French legal system. And it focused on two things. Number one, that the same laws should apply to everybody. And number two, that laws should be written so that they make sense to the common person. The Code Napoleon recognized many of the ideas of the revolution. The right to a fair trial, no secret laws, equality before the law, natural rights, and a lot of things of that in that vein. But it was also fairly conservative. It reversed gains for women's rights to before the revolution, making them so that they were subservient to their fathers or husbands again. It also made slavery fully legal again. All right, the wars of the coalitions. So in 1792, a coalition of conservative states allied against France's revolutionary government. Britain eventually joined them as well. And by 1797, they were defeated, but then there was a second coalition that formed in 1798. They were defeated in 1801, only for a third coalition to form in 1803. In total, France fought against seven different coalitions. And these wars started as a disaster to France. But after the Levee en Masse in 1793, France consistently won these wars. Once France's superb army came under Napoleon's controls, these wars were even more successful. France began to conquer. Napoleon imagined himself the champion of the revolution and repeatedly deposed kings to establish constitutional dictatorships like his own in France. To some of these, he placed his family members, like his brother, as emperor in Spain. But by 1806, most of Western and Central Europe was under France's control. Very little was actually conquered, but just replaced by what are called puppet governments, which are ones that were indirectly controlled by Napoleon. And in these places, the Code Napoleon was put into place, and Napoleonic reforms were applied to the government and the army. This was the first way that the gains of the revolution were spread. Fair trials, natural rights, and constitutions were forced upon many of Europe's governments. But there was also an accidental legacy. People saw the secrets of France's victories. The Levee en Masse, nationalism, and patriotic fervor. The legacy of Napoleon and the Revolution is as much a legacy of war, national hatred, and genocide as it is of freedom, democracy, and rights. By 1812, reforms in many countries, especially Prussia, were creating armies that could rival Napoleon. And more problems were appearing. Napoleon had failed to defeat Britain, and his fleet had been completely destroyed. So he tried to defeat Britain by forcing all people in Europe to just stop trading with Britain, which he called the Continental System. This was inconvenient for Britain, but it made Napoleon's puppet governments hate him, and they were eager to be free of him. And they finally got their chance in 1812. Napoleon made his worst ever mistake. He invaded Russia in the fall of 1812. He destroyed Russia's army easily, but the winter soon settled in, and his army was not ready. Of the 340,000 Frenchmen he brought with him to Russia, only 12,000 returned to France. Now the rest of Europe shook off their chains, and the War of the Sixth Coalition began. It culminated in 1814 at Leipzig in Germany. An army of 350,000 coalition soldiers met an army of 200,000 French soldiers. It was the largest battle in European history to that date. Over a five-day battle, 100,000 people died, and Napoleon was defeated. Within weeks, he had surrendered to the coalition. All right, the Hundred Days in 1815. So the coalition restored the monarchy to France. They thought about killing Napoleon, but they didn't want to make a martyr of him. So instead, they exiled him to a remote Italian island called Elba. However, many back home in France hated this restored monarchy, and they craved Napoleon's return, as yet more gains of the revolution slipped back into feudal inequality. Aided by Italian friends, Napoleon escaped Elba, and he returned to France in 1815. The monarchy fled in terror, and the French army rallied to Napoleon, who they adored. And for 100 days, the French Empire lived again. A seventh coalition formed against him and eventually cornered his army at Waterloo in 1815. There, Napoleon met his final defeat. He was again exiled, but this time to one of the most remote places on Earth, St. Helena, an island in the middle of the southern Atlantic Ocean with no other landmass within 200 miles. He was guarded for the rest of his life by an entire garrison of British soldiers and an entire squadron of British ships. He would die shortly later in 1821 at the age of 51, possibly from cancer or possibly from British poisoning. And that's it. After the Revolution. So after the Revolution, monarchy was restored. By 1815, France again had a monarchy. The nobles returned to their positions of extreme wealth, and in this sense, the Revolution failed. However, the grave inequalities that inspired the Revolution never truly returned. Feudal privileges, which had died in the Revolution, remained dead. Napoleon's great law code stayed as well, and while people didn't have all the rights they wanted, they did at least have some. And in this sense, the Revolution succeeded. The Age of Revolution. But beyond this, an era of repeated revolutions dawned in Europe. People wanted rights and democracy, and they wanted freedom to follow Britain and France's example into the wealth of the growing Industrial Revolution. Over and over, they looked to France. In 1830, there was a second French Revolution. There was a third in 1848. And eventually, the growth of democratic ideas became too hard to resist. By 1900, democracy was the norm rather than the exception in Europe. And all looked back to the French Revolution for their examples. All right, that's the end of it. Big, long reading. Congratulations for getting here. All right, later.